Now, The Push is a dramatic, inspiring memoir by legendary rock climber Tommy Caldwell, the first person to free climb the Dawn Wall of Yosemite's El Capitan. On January 14th, 2015, Tommy, along with his partner Kevin Jorgensen, summited what is widely regarded as the hardest climb in history, Yosemite's nearly vertical 3,000-foot Dawn Wall, after 19 days on the route.
Wow.
So his odds-defying feat was the culmination of an entire lifetime of pushing himself to his limits as an athlete. And this engrossing memoir chronicles the journey of a boy with a fanatical mountain guide father who was determined to instill toughness in his son, to a teen whose obsessive nature drove him to the top of the sport climbing circuit. Tommy's affinity for adventure then led him to the vertigo-inducing and little-understood world of big wall free climbing. But his evolution as a climber was not without challenges. In his early 20s, he was held hostage by militants in a harrowing ordeal in the mountains of, is it Kyrgyzstan? I think
Kyrgyzstan,
I use it.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I never know how to pronounce all the stands. I don't. Soon after, he lost his left finger in an accident.
Kind of like, still climbs?
Like Phil Kagi.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about him,
yeah.
Guitar player. Later, his wife and main climbing partner left him. So now it's starting to sound like we should be playing country music instead. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Anyway, lots to chat about with this guy. He joins us on the line right now. From Tommy, where the heck are you now? Are you in the middle of some wall somewhere now?
No, I'm in Boulder, Colorado.
Of course you are.
I live in Estes Park, Colorado. So, yeah, but Boulder's a pretty popular place for climbers to live.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the show, man. You have been doing a ton of media since, of course, the documentary The Dawn Wall came out. You were doing a ton of media when your book came out. Was there a difference in how media treated you between the Dawn Wall documentary and the book The Push?
No, not really. I mean, it was all surprisingly positive, actually.
We haven't started yet on our show.
Yeah, I mean, the book was a bit of a dark book and like really, really revealing in a lot of ways. So I've been surprised just how positive everything's been, especially because when you asked that question, I thought back to that after that experience in Kyrgyzstan. The media after that was just kind of hectic and not always that positive. But with the book and the movie, it's just a story that people seem quite inspired by, which is cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think anytime somebody has, the overcoming stuff or even just the drive, like, dude, for you to just stick with the Dawn Wall as long as you did and then even just kind of chill until your partner kind of caught up with that one section and was able to join you, because you couldn't think of finishing it without him, right?
Right. Yeah. The movie really kind of hones in on that aspect of the climb, which was huge and was a very, very exciting part of the whole thing for me.
So I used to live up in Hume Lake, which is sort of close to Yosemite, and we would go to Yosemite every once in a while. And the closest I can come to being as cool as you is I climbed Half Dome.
Nice. Yeah, Half Dome is, man, just even hiking up and going up the cable route has got to be one of the best hikes in the world.
That's actually what I meant. Yep, that's all I did.
Yeah.
I took the cable route. Now, that makes it sound like it's a cable car ride, but hold on. What they've done is, I mean, how do you describe the cable route to people?
I mean, Half Dome is this big dome of granite, right? And they installed these cables up the least steep side, but it's still quite steep and scary for people who aren't used to being in exposed places. It's kind of crazy because every day up there in the summer, it's like the biggest group therapy experiment I've ever seen. It's like, hundreds of people, and most of them are scared out of their wits, and they're encouraging each other, and other people are just like backing down, and people die on it occasionally. It's really kind of this interesting microcosm of fear and how people help each other and all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, so it's like every, I don't know, 10 feet, there's a, like a, you know, chain link fence has these posts, and those posts are pounded into the rock or cemented, maybe, I don't know, whatever, but they're affixed.
Yeah, they drill the holes and they stick them in there in the summer, and then they actually pull them out in the winter so avalanches don't wipe out the cable.
Oh, is that what the, okay, so they pull them out. All right, so then they run cables through the top part of these posts, and then about every, I don't know, 40 feet or something, there's a 2x4 or whatever jammed into the rock so you can kind of rest by kind of stepping sideways on the edge of the 2x4. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, all right. I remember getting...
But then in between the 2x4s, which are about 10 feet apart, the rock is so polished from so many people walking on it that it's quite slippery.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if it starts raining or something, you know, people occasionally fall and lose hold of the cables and, you know, plunge to their death.
Yes.
Pretty rare, though.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to climbing, I heard you say, and I didn't know this, that the climbing becomes better because the rock becomes grippier when it's cold. Is that right?
Yeah. So on very, very high-end climbing, you're grabbing onto things that are, you know, holds that are super small, like the edge of a penny or something like that. And so just a little bit of sweat on your fingertips makes a huge difference of whether you can hold on or not. So the colder it gets, kind of the harder your skin is, the harder on the rubber your shoes is, and those little points on the rock or the grit on the rock dig better into your skin and the rubber on your shoes when it's cold. So for stuff that's right at your limit, kind of need it to be cold.
What is the thing that drives you the most nuts, Tommy Caldwell, about posers?
Posers?
Yeah, like, you know what I mean? Like, those that are out there that maybe are trying to look...
I climbed El Capitan.
No, Half Dome.
Sorry,
like
Half Dome, Half
like
Dome.
Me.
Yeah.
I don't judge posers at all.
Really?
You know, everybody's on their own journey, you know?
Oh, man. Because if anybody has a right to judge a climbing poser, it's you, right? So.
Yeah, I just try not to judge in general.
You're going to be one of those nice guys. You could be Canadian. You are so nice, you could be Canadian.
Well, that word poser is probably the most Canadian word I know, actually.
No, that's hoser. Hoser.
Yeah. Oh, hoser.
Can't get away,
right, okay. Oh, yeah, that might be even more Canadian.
Yeah. Now, okay, help me understand the free climbing. Well, help others understand, because I actually do understand this. But when you say free climbing, people think, oh, there's no ropes. There are guys that climb with no ropes. Is that called free climbing, or is that just called nuts?
Yeah, the term free should just be taken out of the whole equation because it confuses everybody. It's terrible. But, yeah, free climbing technically means that you have ropes, but you're climbing the surface of the rock, so the ropes are only there in case you fall. I mean, you cannot climb the ropes themselves. Free soloing means that you have no ropes at all, and if you fall, you die.
Yeah, and that happens. Like, every once in a while you'll hear this story in the news about, oh, this incredible free solo climber who's known around the world has just died from free solo climbing.
It does happen on occasion, although it happens less than alpine. Like, alpine climbers, you know, people that climb big snowy mountains like the ones you guys have in Canada,
yeah,
they die more often than free soloists, generally, because avalanches wipe you off the face and stuff. But, yeah, on occasion, you know, most of the world's best free soloists are no longer with us.
Right.
With a few very, very distinct exceptions.
So my son has this company that goes around to schools and sets up in their gymnasium for the entire week this rock climbing stuff and a rappelling wall. And so the whole school, right, mostly primary school kids, will go through this whole deal and, you know, harnessed up and helmets and, I mean, it's safety is all get. Summit climbing is what it's called. And it's, the kids love this stuff, absolutely love it. And I think what I'm trying to get at here, Tommy, is that climbing is just innate for kids. Kids climb. And if you can provide them the opportunity to be able to do so in a safe, controlled environment at a school, dude, this thing is taking off like crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of these things that feels adventurous. It's kind of got this, like, appeal of being exciting. But if you do it properly and you take the precautions, it is quite safe. You know, if you use ropes, if you're not free soloing, you can, you know, those ropes are strong. And so, yeah, it's got that appeal. Kids love it. Actually, I just was at a kids competition with my family, just like right before I got on this call. And there was like, you know, a couple hundred kids there and between the ages of 4 and 12, and they were absolutely loving it.
Well, that was your big start, wasn't it? Your dad took you out to a big comp and, you know, you were underage, but they let you in and then you smoked everybody. Isn't that how it went?
I wasn't underage because there was no age limit, but I was younger than everybody else. And, you know, climbing competitions weren't really much of a thing back then, so I had no way to judge how good I was compared to anybody else before the competition. But, yeah, that's pretty much what happened. I did quite well, and it was sort of the moment that I realized that I had a knack for it.
Yeah, a knack for it. Yeah, let's call it that. TommyCaldwell.com is the website. DonWall-film.com. DonWall, so D-A-W-N, Wall-film.com. Watch the trailer for this thing and then go watch this flick. It is compelling. The book is compelling. Watching this guy climb is compelling. But behind it all, man, is your story. And that's what I'm the most interested in. I mean, we could talk about climbing all day long, but that would bore a lot of people. So when it comes to your life, though, dude, this hostage thing, you were, what, 22? Is that right?
Yep. Yep.
And how does, so just concisely, I know you told the story 6 million times, but how does someone get taken hostage? Well, like, how does this even happen?
I mean, we just went into part of Kyrgyzstan that was, you know, just in the year of 2000, we just got very unlucky. It got kind of invaded by this rebel group called the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, who essentially was trying to, like, pave a opium trade trail through these remote mountain passes to get drugs from, you know, one border to the other in these remote places where there's not really border security, per se. But they also had, you know, a bit of a holy war going on. I mean, it's pretty politically complicated, but anyways, they came through this valley in Kyrgyzstan that we were climbing. We're actually 1,000 feet up on a wall, and they saw, you know, a climbing group of Americans, the climbing expedition of Americans, and they see that as an opportunity, you know. And so, yeah, they took us hostage.
So how many in the group were taken hostage?
4 of us.
And then there were 2 guys with guns, and you guys, what was it? You were walking around forever. Why? Because they were trying to figure out their game plan?
Well, it was a big rebel insurgency. There's a bunch of them, but this kind of like subgroup of 4 of them came up the valley that we were climbing, and they took us hostage. This kind of war broke out between them and the Kyrgyz military, and we had to abandon everything, like all of our food and warm clothing, as did our captors. And so for 4 days, we were kind of in the middle of this war, hiding from the Kyrgyz military, sort of under gunpoint of rebels of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. 2 of those rebels disappeared. We don't know what happened to them. Kind of on day 2, I think, of the 6 days that we were hostage. And so most of the time, yeah, that's correct. We were with just 2 captors and then the 4 climbers.
Okay, and then one of the 2 takes off for whatever reason. You're left with 1 captor. You hit this moment where it's like, dude, if I push this guy now, he's going to go off the cliff and this ordeal is over. That decision comes, right?
Yep. Yep. Pretty much right. Yeah, on our 6th night, we were climbing. We ended up climbing up this big mountain face with just just 1 remaining captor. The lead guy had tried to go back to our base camp to get some food because by this point we hadn't eaten anything for 6 days. And, it was pretty obvious that it was a opportunity to escape. And it also seemed like if we didn't escape, we probably weren't going to last. Like, we were going to succumb to hypothermia. It was getting cold. It was starting to storm a little bit. And
so did you, Tommy, make this decision totally on your own or at night? Like, were you thinking about it for a few days and at night you'd be whispering to someone else in your team and should I do this, should I not? Or was it just an instantaneous moment? You saw it, you took the opportunity, there it is.
No, it wasn't instantaneous. I mean, we were scheming escape strategies for the entire 6 days, and I was kind of against escaping. I thought it was too risky. I thought we should just try and outlast our captors. I didn't you know, definitely didn't want to, like, kill anybody. Mm-hmm. We'd seen them mark 30 soldiers, you know, point blank right in front of us.
Really?
And, you know, I was quite young at that point.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I was, you know, two of the climbers, me and my girlfriend at the time, we were kind of in the camp of we shouldn't do anything. The other two climbers were on the other side. They really thought we should do something. So it was a weird turn of events that I was the one that ended up pushing the guy, because I was honestly quite against it. It really came down to, like, realizing that we weren't going to live through this unless I took matters into my own hands, and also the fact that the other guys weren't actually going to be able to do it, because you can talk about it a lot, but it's really hard to, you know, walk up to somebody and push them off.
yeah, I've heard. Jeez.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get into the PTSD of all of this, because, well, first of all, I just found out recently, because I'm not sure the film highlighted this, the dude you pushed, he survived?
Yeah, he actually did survive, and they did mention that at the end of the film, actually.
Okay, all right, so...
Yeah, but we didn't know that for several months. A reporter actually found out.
Really?
Which, at first, it seemed so ludicrous to us that at first we thought they were making it up, but... Yeah, it turns out he survived. Dateline NBC did a big piece. They went over and, you know, actually got him on camera in jail.
So, I mean, okay, hold on. I wasn't planning asking a lot of this stuff, but so would you ever go over and, like, do you want to talk to the guy? Do you want to, like, shake hands and have a beer together? Or, yeah, no thanks.
I don't feel any need to do that.
Okay.
No, I don't feel like I have any demons left within me that need to be dealt with.
Right. Okay. But that's what I want to talk to you about, because, like, I interview a lot of people about how do they get through life, especially when life throws them a crazy curveball, right? And a lot of people will lean into, oh, maybe there's a God, and they say there's no atheists in foxholes and blah, blah, blah. But this stuff that you went through, I mean, you got to this point where it was really screwing with you, right?
Really screwing me. I mean, a little bit. I mean, I guess everybody on that trip had elements of PTSD, and we all dealt with it in different ways.
But were you not, because I thought I heard in the documentary at one point you were, like, even willing to go check out church or something.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, briefly. I went to church one time. I mean, anytime something really severe like that happens, it creates a lot of introspection. You start searching.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I did. I went to church at one point, because during those 6 days of, you know, absolute fear and pain, you're kind of trying everything. You're like, maybe I'll pray a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't really know how to deal with this. So
yeah.
You go to those places. Yeah.
Okay, so this is what I'm talking about, right? So along with the PTSD of the hostage situation, and then, like, there's... By the way, explain to everybody, like, the finger is actually a part of the story. We have a guy that we know named Phil Kagi. He's one of the premier guitar players in the world, and he accidentally, when he was young, chopped off one of his fingers when they were... Anyway, they were screwing around at the farm, and something happened. I think it was a well. You know, they were pumping the well, and the finger chopped off. How did you lose your finger?
Table saw.
Dude.
Yeah, just with a table saw. Trying to remodel my little cabin that I owned.
Yeah, that's not cool. All right, and then, not to sound kind of like a jerk here, although I'm quite good at sounding like that, you got dumped, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, the bath with the girl that I was in Kyrgyzstan with, my girlfriend. Right. We got married, and then we were together for 10 years. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I just went through something similar. My wife left me we were separated for 2 years. We just got back together again. I won't bring that up because it's different than your story. But it sucked, man. It was horrible. It was a dark 2 years, really dark.
And it's crazy that so many people in this world go through it. It's quite hard.
Yeah. So being the nature guy, you know, the rock climber dude, you're outside, you know, I mean, you live in Colorado, right? I mean, it's nature 101. There's a lot of people that kind of then dial into the spiritual world, whether it's the indigenous stuff or, you know, maybe they get into the ayahuasca and away they go, or I don't know. Maybe it's Jesus. I don't know. What did you, like, inevitably, what did you discover about your soul, about the insides of you?
You know, spiritually, I don't know if I really discovered anything. I mean, I've gone through sort of like in and out of being like, okay, do I believe in God? Do I not believe in God? And, yeah. You know, I was a child that went to church with my family until the age of like 10 or 11. And then we kind of stopped going. So my dad was kind of similar in that way. And so, yeah, something like Kyrgyzstan happens and I start to wonder if there's, you know, something greater out there. There's kind of like a deeper purpose. So you start wondering about religion. And I would say that I don't know if I never have found any answers, though, honestly. I've sort of used these experiences to dig deep, but then if life is good, I sort of lose track of it.
That's, you know what, that is the most honest answer. I've been doing the show for 16 years. That was the most honest answer we've had. And that doesn't surprise me, because that's the way you wrote your book too. You wrote your book with a massive amount of vulnerability.
Yeah.
And this is why I relate to a lot of your journey, because, I mean, dude, I grew up with a lot of Jesus stuff, and I was even a pastor at one point. And these days, I don't know how anybody can be certain on either side. I am certain there is no God. Really? I am certain there is a God. Really?
Yeah, I mean, people who are certain, I definitely don't. I admire them in a lot of ways. You know, I'm like, man, they've had an experience that makes them so certain. Our belief is such a powerful thing. Like, if you absolutely believe in something, that is really powerful, and it can really direct you and help you heal and whatever. That's just, you know, it's just not me.
Yeah. TommyCaldwell.com. We're going to say goodbye to him in just a second. The website also for the documentary is DonWall-film.com. DonWall-film.com. Tommy Caldwell is the author of The Push, A Climber's Search for the Path. And he's, of course, the star of this documentary, The Don Wall. Yosemite, how do you describe it? I've tried, man. And the only way I can describe it to people who haven't been there is, most national parks, you drive here, you look at something awesome. You drive here, and you look at something awesome. Then you drive over there, and you look at something awesome. Yosemite, you turn the corner, blam, it's all there.
Yeah, I mean, Yosemite is one of the few kind of accessible places I've been in the world where the immensity of it is hard to comprehend. But you look at it, and you're like, how big is that? It's really hard to take in. It feels surreal. I think, you know, almost everybody that goes there is pretty well shocked by the place. I think, you know, in my biased opinion, it's got to be the most beautiful valley I've seen in the world. I've been to some, been all over the place, you know.
Do you have any Ansel Adams prints?
No.
I thought that was like a rite of passage, you know. If you were a climber at Yosemite, you had to have an Ansel Adams print.
Yeah, no, there's lots of, I kind of stick with the more core climbing stuff from people like Tom Frost and Glenn Denny and kind of like the historic people from the, what they call the golden age of Yosemite rock climbing.
Yeah.
Same style though, you know, black and white.
Yeah, right. Beautiful. Now, my son is 6'5". He wanted me to ask you, he's a psycho fan of yours, he wanted me to ask you, is that a benefit to being a climber, or are short dudes, they find it better?
I don't think it really matters. I think strength to weight ratio is a big thing. So I think it's a little bit of a detriment, honestly, because when you're grabbing onto really small holds, the heavier you are, the harder it's going to be to hold on to those holds.
Right.
But you can also reach through blank sections better. So there's been some really, really tremendous tall rock climbers. They're usually pretty skinny, though.
Dude, I wish you the best. I'm so happy for you that, you know, life moves on. Apparently, being a stellar rock climber is like a chick magnet. You're now married to an incredible woman. You got some offspring. How many children do you have?
Yeah, that's right. I got my wife, Becca, and I have two wonderful children. Ingrid, who's just turned 3, and Seth, who's turned 6.
Do you want them to get into the biz or no?
I kind of do. I mean, I'm gonna provide them the opportunity, but then let them choose their own path. I don't want them to do it because I do it. I want them to do it just because it's cool. But, I mean, our lives are incredible. So that's how I got into it, because I realized that traveling the world and climbing and meeting the community of people that are so brought to life by being outside every day and going on these adventures. It's a rad way to live. So I wouldn't be surprised if they see it that way at some point too.
Yeah, you're not wrong, man. I have had messages from more parts of the world. When I told everyone you were coming on this show today, I had people from countries I didn't even know existed tell me that they were stoked that you were on the show today. So you are definitely a world-renowned human being. I appreciate you coming on the show, Tommy Caldwell. Appreciate it a lot. Thank you very much, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Good to talk to you. Take care.
Yeah, you too. Have a good one.
Thanks, man. Tommy Caldwell, author of The Push, A Climber's Search for the Path, star of this documentary, The Dawn Wall. Tim, have you seen it?
No, I've seen bits and pieces of the other one that won the Oscar, like Free Solo or something. Yeah. I can't watch them, to be honest. Like
you get gutty, like spinny?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Gutty?
Yeah.
What does gutty mean?
Butterflies.
That's what I meant. I didn't want to say butterflies, yeah. Though. I wanted
we go for pterodactyls. I got pterodactyls in my gut.
I was trying to get ready for baseball the other day.
All right.
And so I needed to start the hand-eye coordination training again.
So you were doing up your shoes?
So I went into the barn, and I drilled a hole through the baseball, put a rope through it, tied a knot in the bottom,
right.
Threw the rope over the beam, tied it off, and I was going to start swinging. Well, idiot, this is what happened. The first time I hit the ball, it goes and winds itself up on the beam. Now the ball is like 20 feet above my head, and it's wrapped up tight on the beam. So I got to climb the ladder in the barn to the highest beam and then shimmy across to the middle. Now, I've done a fair bit of rock climbing and rappelling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I used to teach people rappelling back in the day.
And you climbed the Half Dome.
Yeah, let's go over that again.
Poser!
Anyway, I got the vertigo.
Oh, yeah.
I went on the Google to find out about the vertigo.
You know, it's funny, as you were telling the story, I was picturing an entirely different thing happening, like the ball swinging around and coming and hitting you somewhere on the way back.
That was the next time. Anyway, listen, changing gears a little bit, I'm glad Tommy joined us on the show because this is the kind of, like, I don't want the whole, you know, this traumatic thing happened in my life. I looked up to the sky and I found Jesus. It's not that way for everybody.
No.
You know, the only reason you guys think it's that way is because that's the only stories you hear in church.
And it's the only story that you know because that was your life.
Exactly. So I wanted to hear from Tommy Caldwell about, what happened? What did you... Because he was searching. There was some tough stuff going on.
Are you kidding? Like, you're... Hostage? Better half leaving you, being a hostage, having to
getting contemplate married, being a hostage.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put him in that order.